Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, May 11th, 2025. This program was previously broadcast on December 1st, 2024. We begin with Science News, the October 19th, 2024 issue. From Notebook, 50 years ago. An excerpt from the October 26, 1974 issue of Science News. Science and the Sources of Pain. Chronic pain is no small problem for thousands of Americans. They take analgesics, sedatives, or tranquilizers. They seek out chiropractors, acupuncturists, or even miracle workers. Often they are not helped, at least over the long run. The reason that so many people aren't getting relief from pain is that clinicians still aren't sure what pain is and how to treat it. Update. Chronic pain still puzzles scientists, but they now know that the mechanisms involve a complex confluence of factors. The nervous and immune systems, emotions, age, and sex all play a role. That understanding has propelled research into better diagnostics and treatments. Scientists recently identified a potential biomarker for chronic pain, activity in a brain region called the orbitofrontal cortex. The finding suggests it's possible to track pain in the brain. And a drug called suzetrigine, which curbs pain by blocking a sodium ion channel on pain-sensing cells, is currently under review by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. First, Mexican free-tailed bats' toes glow in the dark. You've heard of jazz hands? Well, these bats have glow toes. In the dark, when ultraviolet light shines on the Mexican free-tailed bats' extraordinarily hairy toes, they light up like a Christmas tree. That's because the animals have bristly structures that are capable of UV-induced photoluminescence, scientists reported in the August 8th issue of Mammalian Biology. The finding marks the first time photoluminescent structures have been reported in live bats and places the Mexican free-tailed bat on an ever-growing list of creatures that can absorb UV light and re-emit it at a different wavelength. Biologist Fernando Wall Suarez says he will always remember the moment he heard a colleague utter, "Is that normal? Do the feet usually look like that?" It was January 2021, and his team had been catching Mexican free-tailed bats outside of a well-known roost in southern Mexico City. The night before, the researchers had caught bats farther north and dusted them with a powder that shines under UV light. The hope was to later detect that powder on bats in the south, proving that the animals were moving between the locations. "We failed at that," says Wall Suarez of the National Autonomous University of Mexico in Mexico City. However, while searching for signs of the powder with their UV flashlights, the team stumbled upon something even cooler on the powderless bats: glow-in-the-dark toes. In visible light, a Mexican free-tailed bat looks like a fluff of dark fur. To be sure, the photoluminescent footsies weren't a result of powder residue or a local aberration, the researchers looked for and found similarly bright toes on 25 live bats at both sites, as well as on one bat captured more than 700 kilometers to the north. Scientists have found UV photoluminescence in platypuses, tardigrades, and other creatures. While many of these animals glow essentially from head to toe, in the bats, it's just the toes. What purpose the glowing toes serve is unclear. It's not yet known whether the bats can perceive the light wavelengths that appear as a brilliant scion to the human eye. As nocturnal creatures, Mexican free-tailed bats would encounter UV light mostly at dusk, dawn, and nights when the moon is unobstructed by clouds. Because the species migrates long distances and lives in colonies of millions of individuals, perhaps the glow toes aid communication, the team says. This report filed by Jason Biddle. Next, climate news. extinction linked to mega El Niños. Climate swings may have contributed to the great dying, by Jake Bueller. Intense wild swings in climate conditions may have fueled the great dying, the largest mass extinction in Earth's history. A reconstruction of how ancient sea surface temperatures, ocean and atmosphere circulation, and land masses interacted more than 250 million years ago revealed nearly decade-long stints of droughts, wildfires, and flooding. A spike in global temperatures, triggered by carbon dioxide emissions from enormous volcanic eruptions lasting millions of years, probably kicked off the mass extinction some 252 million years ago. But it was the resulting mega El Niños that whiplashed ecosystems, ultimately wiping out some 90% of all ocean species and 75% of those on land, researchers reported in the September 13th issue of Science. The findings suggest that the Great Dying was a bit more nuanced than scientists thought, says Eric Gulbranson, a sedimentary geochemist at Gustavus Adolphus College in St. Peter, Minnesota. Scientists have wondered why the Great Dying, which played out at the border of the Permian and Triassic periods, was so brutal. We have other episodes of global warming in the geological record that don't do anything nearly as bad to ecosystems as this, says paleontologist David Bond of the University of Hull in England. A sharp increase in sea surface temperature, plus the resulting collapse in the ocean's ability to hold dissolved oxygen, would have been abysmal for ocean organisms, but it wasn't clear what drove the extinction of terrestrial life or why organisms couldn't just move to the cooler poles. Part of the answer may lie in short-term oscillations in paleoclimate. Such variations include climate wobbles on the scale of years. For instance, today's El Niño's southern oscillation lasts roughly a year. This periodic warming of the tropical Pacific Ocean brings heat and aridity to northern North America and induces droughts and floods globally. Bond and colleagues reconstructed what ancient Earth's climate patterns looked like. The team calculated seawater temperatures, using ratios of different forms of oxygen in the fossilized teeth of ancient fish-like animals. With this data, plus computer simulations of atmospheric and ocean circulation patterns, the researchers produced a more cohesive picture of climate during the Great Dying. When CO2 levels doubled from about 410 to 860 parts per million and global temperatures rose, El Niño-like spells over one of the late Permian's two giant oceans intensified, the team found. Over time, the swings lengthened to nearly a decade. The effects of these mega El Niños would have been too much for land organisms to bear. As forests baked and died, fewer greenhouse gases were pulled out of the atmosphere, creating a feedback loop as volcanoes continued pumping out warming gases, says study co-author Alexander Farnsworth, a paleoclimate modeler at the University of Bristol in England. You get more warming, more vegetation die-off, stronger El Niños, higher temperatures globally, higher weather extremes, again, leading to more die-off, he says. The heat eventually invaded higher latitudes, which meant species couldn't simply migrate north and south, Bond says. In the end, many species couldn't adapt. Ancient cave stalactites and tree rings might show evidence of the mega El Niños, Gulbranson says. We need to track down these signals in the fossil record. Next, a look at animals from the past. How big were extinct giant creatures? Scientists call for more caution as size estimates get revised, by Carolyn Gramling. Body size estimates of some of Earth's larger-than-life species may have been just that, a little too large for real life. Take Dunkleosteus an armored fish that lived around 360 million years ago. It had long been thought to be as much as 10 meters long, based on the fossilized remains of its massive bony head. But the head-to-body ratio used in that calculation might not have been correct. Instead, the fish was probably about half as long and much stouter, earning it the nickname of Chunkleosteus from some researchers. Size estimates of many extinct giants have been called into question in the last decade as new data and analytical techniques have emerged, researchers reported in the September issue of Ecology and Evolution. To some extent, that's how science works, says evolutionary biologist Joel Gayford and colleagues. But the scale of the size dispute, in some cases, calls for much more caution in making those initial estimates, the researchers say. There's an ongoing trend of high-profile papers publishing world's largest, world's heaviest something, says Gayford, now at James Cook University in Brisbane, Australia. Before long, there's another paper in a lower-profile journal saying, hold on, it wasn't actually that long. When it comes to estimating body size, there isn't always a lot to go on. Megalodon, formerly Otodus megalodon, the largest shark to ever live, left mostly teeth behind. The ancient whale Perusetus, initially estimated to be heavier than the modern blue whale, left just a few vertebrae, ribs, and a single individual's pelvis. To extrapolate from these pieces to a whole animal, scientists may compare the fossils with living or extinct relatives, or plug the data into computer analyses of evolutionary trees. But those extrapolations come with assumptions that can lead researchers astray. Megalodon is one of several examples that Gayford's team zeroes in on. Once thought to be a close relative of modern great white sharks, scientists assumed that Megalodon's body was proportionally broad to match its perhaps 11 meters in length. But a recent study suggested that Megalodon may have been longer, but also more slender. Similarly, the initial size estimate of the whale Perusetus was called into question in February in the journal Peer J. Using different calculation methods, researchers downgraded the whale's weight from up to 340 metric tons to about 100. Still a big whale, just not quite in the same weight class as the blue whale, which can weigh up to 245 tons. Spurious size estimates create lasting bias when it comes to perceptions of how big it's possible to get, Gayford says. Maximum size estimates matter because larger than most species can have an outsized impact on ecology, such as food resources and predator-prey relationships. And changes to the environment, loss of those food sources, for example, can in turn have an outsized impact on the giants. The review correctly points out that we need to be cautious and acknowledge wide margins of error when reconstructing any extinct taxon, says vertebrate paleontologist Jack Cooper of Swansea University in Wales. But the team did not analyze every case study equally rigorously, he says. For example, there is still a lot of debate about how best to estimate Megalodon's size. The review, Cooper says, inaccurately claims his own work on the giant shark, based on a rare vertebral fossil, is unreplicable. He's concerned about what else has been incorrectly reported in the paper. Gaylord says the team was referring to the rarity of the fossil, not criticizing Cooper's work. The intent was to highlight the inherent challenges of estimating sizes from the scant fossil record, he adds. Research journals bear some of the burden for outsized claims, Gayford says. They are less likely to publish detailed, methodologically sound, but not particularly amazing conclusions. And that has a knock-on effect for what people might focus their research on. Downplaying size is one way to address the problem, Gayford suggests. The point is for people to understand that it's not the size or the weight of an animal that makes it interesting, he adds. It's still an awesome animal that we can learn a lot about. And there's a graphic entitled Sizing Up Extinct Animals. Four famous ocean dwellers, known from just a few scant fossils, may each have been less hefty than first thought. At top from left are the skull of the armored fish, the tooth whorl of the fish, Helicoprion, a tooth from the giant shark, Otatus megalodon, and vertebra from the whale, Perocetus colossus. So what the graphic does is it shows fairly accurate pictures, not quite photographic, of these four ocean dwellers. And then below the four drawings, you see outlines of fish so that you see the relative size of these extinct creatures. Next, environmental news. Great Salt Lake dust raises alarm. Small metal-rich particles might harm human health, by Skylar Ware. Dust particles blowing from Utah's Great Salt Lake might pack an unwanted punch if inhaled, metals that can cause inflammation. Metals in the dust are more reactive than dust from nearby lake beds, scientists reported in the November 1st issue of Atmospheric Environment. Drought, overconsumption, and climate change have steadily drained the Great Salt Lake, exposing nearly 2,000 square kilometers of lake bed. Chemical engineer Carrie Kelly of the University of Utah in Salt Lake City and colleagues collected samples of exposed lake bed and isolated dust particles that were no wider than 10 micrometers, small enough to be inhaled. A chemical analysis revealed that the particles had higher concentrations of manganese, copper, iron, and lead than dust from other nearby playas. Lithium and arsenic were also present at levels exceeding the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's regional screening levels, a reference point for further risk evaluation. The particles were also more likely to generate reactive oxygen species than dust from the other lake beds. These unstable molecules can interact with and sometimes damage living cells. If we get too much of these reactive particles or reactive species that enter our lungs, it can lead to inflammation, and then inflammation leads to a number of adverse health effects, Kelly says. Biomedical scientist David Lowe advises against jumping to conclusions. It's fine to look at environmental components and to look at their potential for having this or that effect, he says. And he works at the University of California, Riverside. But linking this reactive dust exposure with public health outcomes will require more data, he says. The study, Kelly says, shows that the dust from the Great Salt Lake is potentially a significant health concern, so we need to do more work. And what's the latest news in quantum physics? The Large Hadron Collider exposes quarks' quantum entanglement. Quantum entanglement has made its way to the top. Scientists have measured the strange quantum phenomenon of entanglement in top quarks, the heaviest known fundamental subatomic particles. It's the first detection of entanglement between pairs of quarks, a class of subatomic particles that make up larger particles, including protons and neutrons. Using data from proton collisions, scientists with the ATLAS experiment, a particle detector at the Large Hadron Collider near Geneva, studied smash-ups that formed a top quark and a top antiquark. The two particles were entangled via a quantum property called spin, which means that measuring the spin of one particle would immediately tell you the other. To detect the entanglement, researchers observed the particles that the top quark and antiquark decayed into. The angles at which these particles were emitted revealed the entanglement, the team reported in the September 19th issue of the journal Nature. As quarks go, top quarks are special. Generally, when quarks are cut loose in high-speed collisions, pairs of quarks and antiquarks quickly materialize, glomming together into larger particles. This process of hadronization washes out any entanglement. But top quarks and antiquarks decay so fast that hadronization can't occur, so the particles that they decay into can carry the signature of their entanglement. That means, for demonstrating entanglement, top quarks have the upper hand. This update posted by Emily Conover. More news on the climate. U.S. temperature-linked deaths could double by mid-century. Heat-related deaths in the United States are on the rise, but how bad will it be 20, 30, or 40 years from now? Scientists now have a clue. Extreme temperatures, both hot and cold, contribute to over 8,000 deaths every year. Within the next few decades, that number could double or even triple as the climate changes due to greenhouse gas emissions, researchers reported in the September issue of JAMA Network Open. JAMA is the Journal of American Medical Association. Cardiologist Samid Katana of the University of Pennsylvania and colleagues estimated how many U.S. deaths are now associated with extreme temperatures by comparing the number of days with extreme temperatures and the number of deaths from 2008 to 2019. Projections of temperatures and population sizes let the team estimate the number of deaths associated with extreme temperature for a future with a lower increase in greenhouse gas emissions and one with a higher increase. By 2036 to 2065, the annual number of deaths could double in a future with a lower increase in emissions, or triple in one with a higher increase. This article posted by Andrea Tamayo. And in agriculture, smart lighting might make vertical farming more affordable. Fiddling with the dimmer switch might help some indoor farmers curb soaring electricity costs. Growing crops in stacked rows indoors under fixed intensity lights can produce more food per square meter while using less water than traditional outdoor farms. But this vertical farming technique is also energy intensive and expensive. Now, researchers have designed a computer program that controls lighting to optimize both photosynthesis and electric bills. Described in the Frontiers in Science issue on September 24th, the computer program adjusts the intensity of grow lights hourly based on the changing cost of electricity. This smart lighting could cut vertical farms' electricity costs by 12%, says horticulturist Leo Marcellus of Wageningen University in the Netherlands, potentially saving some farms tens of thousands of dollars annually. Experiments with leafy greens suggest that crops can grow under dynamic artificial lighting just as well as under fixed-intensity lights, Marcellus and colleagues found. Future research will test dynamic lighting on larger scales, he says. This article posted by Sophie Hartley. And we take a look at animals that have bacteria on the brain. Fish, to be exact. Members of the salmon family harbor active microbial communities inside their brains, evolutionary immunologist Irene Salinas of the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque and colleagues reported in the September 20th issue of Science Advances. Probing the brains of lab-raised and wild fish, including rainbow trout, Atlantic salmon, Chinook salmon, and Gila trout, revealed that the fish had brain microbiomes. The bacteria may have hailed from different organs, crossed the blood-brain barrier, and adapted to living in the brain, genetic analyses suggest. Bacteria invading animals' brains is typically linked with disease. The finding hints that brain bacteria may not be bad news for fish, as the animals seemed healthy. Perhaps the bacteria help fish sense microbial cues in the environment, Salinas suggests. This article posted by Aaron Garcia de Jesus. And finally, in the Department of Health and Medicine, a study in mice hints at a new way to treat spinal cord injuries. After a spinal cord injury, some mouse nerve cells swell, stay that way longer than expected, and begin dying. A drug that reduces swelling improved the mice's recovery, scientists reported in the September 25th issue of Science Translational Medicine. A team led by neuroscientist Bo Chen of the University of Texas Medical Branch at Galveston examined tens of thousands of neurons in mouse spinal cords. Inhibitory neurons, which dampen other cells' activity, swelled quickly after an injury, peaking at day 2 and returning to normal size by day 14. But excitatory neurons, which ramp up other cells' activity, stayed swollen for up to 35 days, and more of them died. Giving mice bumetanide, a drug used to treat edema, decreased cell swelling and death, and improved leg movement. Neuron swelling may be an important part of spinal cord injuries in people, but more research is needed to understand how this process works and whether bumetanide might help, Chen says. This article posted by Laura Sanders. This series of articles appears in the October 19, 2024 issue of Science News. And now, turning to the October 2024 issue of Scientific American, we take a quick look at history, 50, 100, and 150 years ago. What happened? This compilation by Mark Fischetti. In 1974, 50 years ago, best baseball batting order. Managers and baseball strategists give much thought to the batting order, following such precepts as putting a good runner first and a big hitter in the cleanup, or fourth, spot. Does it make any difference? R. Alan Freeze of the University of British Columbia, writing in the journal Operations Research, says the effect of using the best batting order rather than the worst is less than 3 extra wins per 162-game season. Freeze conducted a computer simulation of some 200,000 baseball games with teams in the traditional lineup, a second lineup of hitters in descending order of productivity, and a third lineup in ascending order. 100 years ago, in 1924, life and limb for airmail. We pay tribute to the people of the Post Office Transcontinental Airmail Service, the greatest single step ever taken to make commercial aviation a practical day and night reality. Very much to the point is the following quotation from a talk by Captain Hyde Pearson, a veteran of the World War, shortly before he was killed in the airmail service. "We risk our necks," he says. "We give our lives. We perfect a service for the benefit of the world at large. While you sit in the safe shelter of your office or sleep in the secure comfort of your bed, these boys by day and by night may be sweeping through rain or snow or fog or the blackness of the night with death ever at their shoulder in the performance of a duty whose pay is small, whose risks are great, and whose only reward can be the gratitude and admiration of the American public." In that same year, mummies demystified. At the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago, it was found possible to take X-ray photographs of a group of Peruvian mummy packs. To have unwrapped these mummy packs to ascertain whether they contained objects of special interest would have meant their destruction. By means of the X-ray pictures, it is possible to learn what has been buried with the body. In the packs thus far examined have been found ears of corn, pottery, vessels of clay containing shells, bits of metal, gourd vessels, beads, clay figurines, cut bone objects, or in some instances, nothing. It is also possible to gather something definite concerning the age, sex, and condition of the bony structure of the body buried therein. Also in 1924, Lady Edison, inventor and entrepreneur. Lady Edison, as she is called, has 47 inventions to her credit and a diversity which is truly remarkable. The Lady Edison is Miss Beulah Louise Henry in New York. Here is a list of a few of her inventions. Telephone call list. Handbag with interchangeable covers. Hair curler. Ice cream freezer. Pencil. Electric fan shield. Rubber reducing garment. Kitty clock for teaching time. Glove snaps. And a roulette top. Miss Henry does not claim to have any special mechanical talent, and she torpedoed the idea that invention is the product of solitude. The solution of the snapper that fastens the corners of the umbrella to the frame came one day when I was preparing to go to a matinee with my mother, she recalled. The biggest umbrella men in the country said it could not be done. Of course, I did not believe them. I have my inventions patented in 4 different countries, and I am president of 2 newly incorporated companies. 100 years ago in 1874, call me a scient. Mr. Proctor recently asked for a single word which should convey the meaning of man of science. Mr. Goss has recently suggested the name scient, a word which receives the approval of Mr. A.J. Ellis, who, in the journal Academy for September 19th, says, "I beg leave formally to introduce a scient and to propose that this strictly formed disyllable should take the place of the American barbaric trisyllable scientist." It will be seen, however, from the letter of a correspondent that the word is not entirely unobjectionable, as it may be confounded with science when it is spoken in the plural. We suggest that our cousins call him the sci-ist, which will be okay, used in the singular or plural. And there you have it, history compiled by Mark Fischetti in the October 2024 issue of Scientific American. Next, in this same issue of Scientific American, Q&A with Boris D. Heifetz. The interviewer is Gary Stix, a senior editor covering mind and brain at Scientific American. What makes a psychedelic experience? Is it chemical, empirical, or mental and subjective? A debate has long percolated among researchers as to what happens after a person takes a psychedelic drug. The experience may stem at least in part from the placebo effect, which is rooted in the belief that taking psilocybin or ketamine will somehow be transformative. Boris D. Heifetz, an associate professor of anesthesiology at the Stanford University School of Medicine, has been tackling this question amid his broader laboratory investigations of what exactly happens in mind and brain when someone takes a psychedelic. How much of their sometime life-altering experience is chemical or empirical, and how much is mental and subjective? It turns out the effects may consist of a lot more than just a simple biochemical response to a drug activating, say, the brain's serotonin receptors. Heifetz recently had a conversation with Scientific American about his years-long quest to define the essence of the psychedelic experience. An edited transcript of the interview follows. The first question that Gary Stix asks, are we coming any closer to understanding how psychedelics work, including in the context of therapy? Are we closer to using these transformational experiences to treat psychiatric disorders? And Boris Heifetz responds, having been in this field for a while, I still face this inescapable problem of how to study psychedelics. One framework that I find very useful is thinking about it in 3 categories. There's the biochemical drug effect, which involves basic brain biology, chemicals interacting with receptors on cells. That happens whether or not you can feel the effect of the drug. Then there is the conscious experience related to changes in sensation and revelatory, hallucinatory, and ecstatic feelings. These experiences are closely tied to taking the drug, and usually we think of them as caused by the drug. But it is quite difficult to say whether a lasting change in mood or outlook was a result of the drug, a biochemical effect, or of the trip itself, the experiential effect. The third factor, then, is all those aspects of the overall drug experience that are independent of the drug or trip, the non-drug factors, what psychologist and psychedelics advocate Timothy Leary called the set and setting. How much do your state of mind and the setting in which you take a drug influence the outcome? This category includes expectations about improvement in, say, your depression, expectations about the experience, the stress level in the environment. It would also include integration, making sense of these intense experiences afterward and integrating them into your life. And it's useful to put each of these things in its own box, because I think each of them is somewhat isolated. The goal is to make each box smaller and smaller, to really deconstruct the pieces. So how have you gone about examining all this? One example of how we've used this framework in our research is an experiment in which we gave participants with depression ketamine during general anesthesia. The idea was to explore just the biochemical drug effect by blanking out conscious experience to see whether people got better from their depression. Our intention with this experiment was to get at this question that a lot of people have been asking: is it the drug or the trip that is making someone better? You can address that question in a couple of different ways. One is to redesign the drug to eliminate the trip. But that is a very long process. As an anesthesiologist, my solution was, of course, to address the problem with the use of general anesthesia. We used the anesthetics to basically suppress conscious experience of the associated psychological effects of ketamine, which many people think may be relevant and even crucial to the antidepressant effects. We collaborated closely with psychiatrists Laura Hack and Alan Schatzberg, both at Stanford Medicine, and we designed the study to look like every ketamine study in the past 15 years. We picked the same type of participants, people with moderate to severe major depressive disorder who had failed to improve with other treatments for moderate or severe depression. We administered the same questionnaires. We gave the same dose of ketamine. The difference was these participants happened to be coming in for surgery for hips, knees, hernias, and while they were under general anesthesia, we gave them a standard antidepressant dose of ketamine. Because the patients were under anesthesia and couldn't tell whether they were on a drug or not, this may have been the first blinded study of ketamine. What was surprising was that the placebo group, who received no ketamine, also got better, indistinguishably from those who received the drug. Almost 60% of the patients had their symptom load cut in half, and there was at least 30% remission from major depressive disorder. These were patients who had been sick for years, and that finding was a big surprise. In a sense, it was a failed trial in that we couldn't tell the difference between our two groups. What I take from that is really that this doesn't say much about how ketamine works. What it does say is just how big a therapeutic effect you can attribute to non-drug factors. That's what people call the placebo effect. It's a word that describes everything from sugar pills to our surgeries. In our case, it may have had something to do with the preparation for the surgery. We messaged patients early. We engaged with them early. They weren't used to people being interested in their mental health. What did you discuss? We talked to them for hours. We heard about their histories. We got to know them. I think they felt seen and heard in a way that many patients don't going into surgery. I'm thinking about parallels with the preparation steps for psychedelic trials. Patients in both types of research are motivated to be in these studies. In our study, they were told that they were testing the therapeutic potential of a drug, and that there was a 50-50 chance they might get it. And then there was the big event of actually having the surgery. In this case, it was similar to having a psychedelic trial, a big, stressful, life-impacting event. The patients closed their eyes and opened them after the surgery, and in many cases, they had the sense that no time had passed. They knew they went through something because they had the bandages and scars to prove it. What I take from that is that these non-drug effects, such as expectations of a particular outcome, are almost certainly present in most psychedelic trials and are independently able to drive a big therapeutic effect. It became obvious that people had powerful experiences. Most people don't spontaneously improve from years of depression. After surgery, they got worse. They get worse. That's what the data show. And the fact that we're able to make this degree of a positive impact after hours and hours of interpersonal contact and messaging, that's important. This was a very clear demonstration to me that non-drug factors, such as expectations and feelings of hope, contribute a substantial portion to the effects we've seen. And you would be foolish to disregard those components in designing a therapy. And, you know, the truth is that most clinicians make use of these techniques every day in building a rapport with patients, leveraging this placebo response. Does that suggest in any way that the effects of psychedelics might be substantially, or perhaps entirely, placebo effects? So this is where I think you have to ask the question, what do we mean by placebo? Characteristically, people use the word placebo in a kind of dismissive way, right? If a person responds to placebo, the subtle implication is that there was nothing wrong, and that's not what we're talking about here. Think about everyday situations that bring about life changes. A heart attack or near-death experience may cause someone in a high-stress job to change their job and lifestyle habits. Exercising and eating better. That all can be grouped under the label of a placebo effect. Another possibility to achieve the same goal is having a transformational experience that you then use to make changes in your life. So the question is, how do you do this in a practical way? You can't exactly go out and give people heart attacks or even send them on life-changing experiences, such as skydiving or trips to the Riviera. But you can give them a psychedelic. That's a big, powerful experience. In many cases, that is unique in some people's lives and confers the opportunity to make changes for the better. How does giving an actual psychedelic drug to someone in a clinical trial relate to the three categories you mentioned earlier? And those three categories were the biochemical drug effect, which involves basic brain biology, the conscious experience related to changes in sensation and revelatory, hallucinatory, and ecstatic feelings, and then the aspects of the overall drug experience that are independent of the drug or trip, the non-drug factors. Let's circle back to this idea that psychedelic transformation could rely on the biochemical effect, the experience of the trip itself, or non-drug factors. Our study of ketamine during anesthesia really highlighted the role of non-drug factors, such as expectation, but didn't really get at the question of, is it the drug or the trip? To answer that, some of my scientist colleagues are testing non-psychedelics or non-hallucinogenic psychedelic derivatives to see whether patients with depression, for example, get better after treatment with a drug that can cause some of the same biochemical changes as a classical psychedelic, but doesn't have a trip associated with it. That's taking the trip out of the drug. But what if you could take the drug out of the trip, meaning creating an experience that is reproducible across people that checks many of the same boxes as a classic psychedelic-induced trip, but doesn't actually require the use of a psychedelic molecule? So what, in this context, you provide people with is a profound experience that can even be somewhat standardized so you can study it. And it would be powerful and vivid and revelatory with a long-lasting impact. Do you get the same effects without a psychedelic? That would not be definitive evidence, but it would strongly suggest that maybe there's nothing intrinsically special about the activity of a drug that activates a particular receptor that mediates the effects of psychedelics. What that would do is put front and center the role of human experience in psychological transformation. So you might be able to bypass the need for a psychedelic drug if you can get the same result with a non-psychoactive drug? Maybe you can. We just don't know. That's an empirical question. To try to answer it, I've worked closely with Harrison Xiongwen Zhao, also an anesthesiologist at Stanford, on a protocol that we call dreaming during anesthesia. It's really a state of consciousness that happens before emergence from anesthesia. When patients awaken from surgery, they progress from a state that is deeper than sleep. And they pass through a number of conscious states, some of which produce dreams. About 20% of patients will have some dream memory imagery. What we do is prolong that process and use EEG, electroencephalography, to home in on a specific biomarker of that state. We can hold someone in this pre-emergent state for 15 minutes. Participants wake up, and the stories they tell are very hard to ignore. These are some of the most vivid dreams they've ever had. They say things like, "That was more real than real." The participants with physical trauma dream of reintegrating their body map, reimagining their body as once again whole. We had a participant who had been assigned male at birth and had gender-affirming surgery. She had been in the military and reimagined her life before her gender-affirming care. She saw herself doing high-intensity military training exercises, now with her body aligning with her gender. These are intense experiences, vivid, emotionally salient, possibly hallucinatory. We published a couple of case reports where we actually have seen therapeutic effects on par with what we see in psychedelic medicine. Powerful experiences followed by a resolution of symptoms in a psychiatric disorder. What we're seeing is a shared physiology in terms of EEG results for these dream states and the EEGs for psychedelics. We see at least some shared phenomenology in terms of description of the experiences, and there are also similar therapeutic effects. What are some of your next steps? In addition to possibly producing a very compelling therapeutic using the common anesthetic propofol, we are working hard to develop experimental tools based on anesthesia, using our knowledge of how placebo works in the brain to separate these three factors: the drug effect, the experiential effect, and non-drug factors. At least two of those big effects, neither of which depends on administering a psychedelic, appear to be capable of generating a profound therapeutic impact that certainly would be sufficient on its own to claim the outcomes seen in psychedelic trials. And that, to me, shows that maybe the emphasis is misplaced when we're focused on re-engineering the drug to get rid of hallucinogenic effects. We should be focused on re-engineering the experience. But we're still working on number three, the drug effect. We have collaborations with David E. Olson, a chemist at the University of California, Davis, who has pioneered the use of non-hallucinogenic psychedelics. We are helping to characterize the profound neuroplastic effects of a drug he has developed that appears, at least in mice, not to trigger the same type of brain activation that classic psychedelics do. What I'm trying to convey is that, using these approaches, we are able to get some traction to experimentally define, isolate, and identify the components of this very complex therapeutic package we call psychedelic therapy. The questions in this Q&A were asked by Gary Stix, a senior editor covering mind and brain at Scientific American. The answers were provided by Boris D. Heifetz, an associate professor of anesthesiology at the Stanford University School of Medicine. This Q&A appears in the October 2024 issue of Scientific American. A New York Times trilobite posted on November 25, 2024, tells us why squirting cucumbers shoot their seeds like botanical bombardiers. Scientists say they've worked out how the plant can fire its seeds up to almost 40 feet. Written by Carolyn Wilkie. The hairy, ground-hugging vines of the squirting cucumber might seem like an ordinary weedy plant, but take a closer look at the plant, which grows in dry, barren areas in the Mediterranean, and you'll find an extraordinary thing, said Chris Thorogood, a botanist at the University of Oxford Botanic Garden and Arboretum. The roughly 1.5-inch fruits of the squirting cucumber contain toxic chemicals and are distinguished in another way from the green rounds you might put on a salad. When they're ripe, they eject their seeds very violently in a stream of mucilage, Dr. Thorogood said. They can shoot up to almost 40 feet. The Roman naturalist Pliny the Elder wrote about these plants around 2,000 years ago. It's long been a mystery why and how the plants can carry out this act of vegetative bombardment, Dr. Thorogood said. In a paper published a few weeks ago in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Dr. Thorogood and his colleagues share how the squirting cucumber goes ballistic. Researchers knew that pressure builds up inside the fruits before they blow. Initially, we all thought it was rather straightforward, said Finn Box, a physicist at the University of Manchester and another author of the study. But they decided to take a closer look, recording high-speed video of the cucumber cannons in action. The ripe fruit detaches from the stalk, opening a hole in the cuke's base. From there, the researchers found, seeds emerge at speeds of up to 66 feet per second. As the fruit detaches, the stem recoils. The fruit rotates backward, changing the angle at which seeds shoot. As slimy fluid spews out, depressurizing the fruit, the seed's speed drops. The whole process takes about 30 milliseconds. The group also made time-lapse photos of stalks bearing fruit for several days. In the run-up to a seed-squirting event, the ovoid fruits moved from dangling nearly straight down to a roughly 45-degree angle with the stem. That was just something that blew our minds, Dr. Box said. There's a perfect angle and an organism finds it, said Marcus Roper, a mathematician at the University of California in Los Angeles, who wasn't involved with the work. If the seeds shot out nearly vertically, they wouldn't have enough forward velocity to go far. If spit nearly horizontally, they quickly fall to the ground. But the squirting cucumber lines up along the sweet spot, an intermediate angle. The team's time-lapse imagery provided clues about how this occurs. Before the launch, the plant's stem becomes wider, straighter, and longer. The cucumber appears to contract. That suggests that liquid moves from fruit to stem, stiffening the stem so it can hoist the fruit. It's still not clear what biological mechanism the plant might use to bulk up its stem. The researchers also calculated the pressure within the cucumber and found that it's similar to that of an inflated mountain bike tire, Dr. Box said. Using that and other data they collected on the plant, the researchers worked out the math behind the dispersal of seeds. That allowed them to simulate how hypothetical mutant plants would spread differently. For instance, a stiffer stem would disperse most seeds very near the parent plant. Alternatively, a more pressurized fruit would shoot seeds forward and backward. Over several generations, these mutants wouldn't spread as far as the squirting cucumber that occurs naturally, the team found. It gave us a sense of how fine-tuned evolution has made this particular species for dispersal, said Derek Moulton, an applied mathematician at the University of Oxford and another author of the research. The squirting cucumber shows how plants evolve ways to spread their seeds while being rooted. For plants to generate rapid motion, they had to do something a bit clever, he said. Finding the physical basis of weird biological things can be useful, said Angela Hay, a plant biologist at the Max Planck Institute for Plant Breeding Research in Cologne, Germany, who wasn't part of the new study. The squirting cucumber has already inspired at least one strategy for delivering drugs within the body. Because of the process and time scale of evolution, she said, it can often come up with design principles that, as engineers, we haven't thought of. And this New York Times trilobite, squirting cucumbers shoot their seeds like botanical bombardiers, gives us a different spin on luncheon salad. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ehlich, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week.